Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello everybody, my name is Martin Gregg and from Backpage you're listening to the big interview with Graeme Hunter at the Euros. It's the day before the final of Euro 2020 and I'm not going to call it match day minus one, but Graeme Hunter is on the line to discuss England-Italy. Now, Graeme, we've got a nice themed episode coming up, but I just want to check in about tomorrow night's game. And I think, generally, the right two teams are in the final, and it's probably a 50-50 game.
Yeah, I'm not angry about who's in the final. There have been times when I've thought, this isn't legitimate, there's been an incident which drives me crazy. I've said all I want to say about Azerbaijani linesmen and Jeff Hurst and Raheem Sterling and penalties and whatever. There was a much, I think, around the country, there's been a much fiercer debate about the merits of that penalty, and I wanted to treat it with a little bit of sardonic humour on the night, and therefore I'm not ranting about England being in the final, because in my view on the night against Denmark they outplayed them, they made some seriously good chances, and I don't have a complaint at all that England came out of that semi-final. And what's more, I agree with your idea about it being 50-50, and I won't be shocked if Italy win it. But I have a sense of, not just a sense of inevitability, I have a sense that, for example, that penalty confirmed, like I said the other night, England's gradual ascension into getting performances, getting decisions, forcing decisions, forcing luck that, across my life, not just across my career, the bigger international sides consistently got. You learn that, just like a side like Scotland, that you can repeatedly, you know, twist a kaleidoscope and say, what bad luck we've had. But if you're saying that once every 2 years for 40 years, then you learn that there's something above and beyond bad luck. And I think the converse is true. I'm not sure if it's converse or inverse, so I'm just going to say it with conviction, because that's what big players do. They say it with conviction and they carry it off, and then in the papers the next day they say, he got it wrong, and I say, well, it's too late, because winners write history. When big sides come away consistently with moments like that, it marks them down as winners. Not all winners across history have done it with panache and brutality and a handsome margin. You win any old how. I think England have got that. So, you know, you asked about my feeling. You'll ask me more about what you want to share about the way the final might develop. But looking at it from a distance and for a couple of weeks now, it's felt to me that even when England are vulnerable, even when things don't necessarily click, they're wholly different now. They're a team with a system. And the things that have made me believe now since before Ukraine, because I didn't have any doubt they would beat Ukraine, but the performance they put in that day, plus the performance against Germany, not the scoreline, the performance, plus the large part of the performance against Denmark, told me that they've got reserve. I think they've got, you know, that a lot of focus is put upon Southgate's 11, and that's understandable because that's always the headline ticket. But you know, I haven't done a calculation since earlier on in the tournament, and I think it was that day, it was Neil I was speaking to, but at the point where I last spoke about it, I think 71% of the goals were coming in second halves and in extra times. Now, listen, while we're speaking, I could probably do that calculation right now, because, so here we are, in first halves, 51 goals have come in the first half, whereby 97 goals have come after half-time. So that's a slightly changed proportion, but it's heavily towards teams that can accelerate in the second half or that can accelerate. I mean, one of the big proportions are, in fact, the biggest proportion of goals come between 46 and 60. So that's half-time. The managers have had a chat. You've all had a glass of orangeade. You've patted each other on the back. The masseur's been over your thighs. And then there's a spurt between 46 and 60. That's 30 goals. The biggest number of goals, if you split it up into periods of time, comes between 46 and 60. But the next biggest number of goals come between minutes 76 and 90. And I'm relating that back to, I'm not talking Italy down, but I think if you look across now a sort of phalanx of players that probably, let's leave the fullbacks out of this, although I could easily imagine Reece James coming on and marauding down the wing and imposing himself and creating a goal. That's easy to do, but let's leave the defenders out of it. Moving forward from Henderson through Sacco, Mount, Foden, Grealish, and even Everton centre-forward Calvert-Lewin, there's a big phalanx of footballers there who haven't run themselves into the ground, who've either been used sparingly or have so little kilometres in their legs that you could genuinely expect them to be able to take a game away from an opponent this Sunday night. So I think a combination of respect for the way in which... There's another thing too. Your man, Steve Holland, it frustrates me a little bit because he's one of the few major players in this that I haven't had direct experience with. Reputation very good. And I love the way that there's a... To my way of understanding, there's a clear delineation between him and Southgate. It's not to suggest that Southgate doesn't have a tactical brain, but I've never honestly looked at him and thought there's somebody who's standout at reading the game. He seems to me to be an absolute standout at reading people. Now, I'm not comparing him to Ferguson in achievements, but as much as Alec understood football and was an inveterate gambler and a brilliant percentage gambler, his massive, massive strength was people, understanding people, undermining people, inspiring people, changing people, giving support to people. Ferguson was, I think, first and foremost, apart from hard and a winner, his skill lay in how to utilise human resources or how to destroy human resources. Southgate's a different milkier tea version of that. But the match between him as a leader, as an organiser, as a people man, as somebody who sets standards, somebody who reads a group mood, who reads a national mood, and then apparently on the touchline, he's completely unabashed about taking tutorials on the... There's no way that he goes into the dugout, turns his back on the cameras, speaks directly down to Holland sitting down as if to say, look, you can't see what I'm saying, you can't see who's the dominant partner here. He's out there, doesn't give a hoot that you can see the two halves of the orange. And again, I really like that, and I think it's useful to us analytically because we're beginning to see how England compute things. So I've left a lot of, you know, out there about why I think that England will win it, but I buy your idea that Italy are much more hard-boiled. Many more of them have been this course or something similar to it. There's a different dynamic between Mancini and Vialli and even Lombardo. I think there's a massive power and momentum. Those three have known each other for, you know, practically their entire adult lives. I think that if you look at there's a contagious spirit within the Italy camp of we can play with most teams, we can outwork most teams, we're more streetwise than almost every team, and boy, we believe in the leader. There's a cult thing going on now. If you remember, Martin, I think of all the interviews we've had, and you've produced and edited a lot of the content to the extent that you'll know it better than me. But when Micah Richards said to us, and you listen to the way in which he worked hard to win Mancini over, worked hard to put up with being told you're not good enough positionally, and took the advice, worked on it, and adored what Mancini did for him, and adored being part of that league winning team. But by the end he said, and he said it frankly, there were people in that dressing room who he'd lost. Now we don't see that. We don't see the outside, there's so much fixation on he's still slim, he's still elegant, his hair is luxurious and Samson-esque. Look at his wardrobe and all that bullshit. It's nice to describe that. It would be ignoble to ignore it. But it doesn't tell you anything about what's revitalised an Italy side that was in pieces when he took over. And which when, you know, not long ago Spain were comfortably pumping 3-0 in qualifying. So my point of view would be this. There's a ruthless, hard, detailed, driven culture within the Italy camp. And I'll throw one last thing is that I don't yet know how Chiesa is. And I don't want to make too big a deal of it, but when he came off, I'd spotted him holding the back of his thigh prior to him being substituted. At the beginning of the second half, that laughing and joking with Luis Enrique will stand with me for longer than people talking about Chiellini and Alba. It was remarkable. And Chiesa looks as if he's going to be special. He might not be a world-class footballer, but he's got equally what his father had, is that ability to not only find himself in the right place at the right moment, but do something with that golden spot. So I hope he's fit, because that will make it a better final. But I think without being definitive about Italy's chances, that would be naive. Chiesa being fully fit, I think, changes the jigsaw a lot. And I'll wait before I start pronouncing on who I think is definitively going to win, I'll wait to see how Chiesa is. But at this moment, looking forward to tomorrow night's final, I'm unashamedly saying that I think that England have the momentum, the understanding and the resources, irrespective of being at home. I'm sometimes unsure, you know, until you learn how to handle it, whether being at home with all this build-up, with all this pressure, is automatically an undivided advantage. It should be a plus. If you're struggling and the crowd is roaring you on, it should give you some adrenaline. Whether it's an absolute automatic, if they go one or two down and the crowd is basically wearing brown trousers, that's not a help. So we'll see. But at this stage, at this distance, using my trusty binoculars, Martin, it's England.
We do have a lot of questions to get through, and this is why I'm just going to name check Daniel Hanna, who submitted a question about Fede Chiesa. He says he's been a gladiator this tournament, constantly scrapping, legs flying, arms nudging, and technically gorgeous. It's been a long time since we've seen someone like him from Italy. He says, how far can this guy go? Could he be the difference against England? So I think you've kind of addressed that. If he's fit, then it could be very, very exciting. There is one question which is going to kind of form the core of this episode, which is, occasionally we do get questions in from the socials that kind of make us take our breath and think about where we could take the question. We did it a couple of months ago with Merin Murto's question about Madrid's three-peat team, which we made into an episode with Pete Jensen. I hope you enjoyed that one. This question is from one of our socials, Robert Ryan, who asks, the last time England faced Italy in a major tournament was in 2014, when they lost 2-1 at the Brazil World Cup. What one player would you choose from each side to complement each of today's teams? So just to give you a little bit of background on that game, that was the opening game of the 2014 World Cup for Italy and England. 2-1 to Italy, goals from Marchisio and Balotelli, and Sturridge for England. Rewatching the highlights earlier, it was interesting. England probably should have got at least a draw from the game, but of course they ended up going out in the group stages. I think it was after just two matches they were eliminated, if memory serves me right. But anyway, the England team that day was Joe Hart in goal, Glenn Johnson, Phil Jagielka, Gary Cahill, Leighton Baines, midfield Henderson, Gerrard. Then there's Raheem Sterling, who was probably playing just behind Sturridge up front. And then you have Welbeck and Rooney on the wings. So obviously, given that Sterling will play tomorrow and Henderson's in the squad, you know, you've got the choice of the remaining names. I did go back to Robert and asked him directly who he would choose. And he says, England, I don't want to sound cliched, but Wayne Rooney. I actually think a lot of the current team I wouldn't change, but I'm not sure the England 10 position has been owned by a Mason Mount, Grealish or Foden just yet, even if sometimes the formation has restricted that. A 2014 Wayne Rooney with Grealish off to his left and Sancho or Sterling. He said, I'm nearly buying an England strip myself. So that's great thoughts from Robert himself. What about you, Graham? Looking at that lineup, is there anyone you would pluck out and parachute in tomorrow night?
Well, first of all, as somebody who's been known to sell old fish as fresh fish in my life, depending on the circumstances, you've just given me a reminder that all crime needs complicity. And you are complicit in a great scam that Roberto's just carried off there, because not only he's got split nationality, and he ain't buying no England strip. I know he said that, but you've read it out as if it might be true. He's a big man for his club side, who are Scottish champions. He'd be a big man for Scotland, but above all, he'd be a big man for the Azzurri. So I know he used this phrase to make a point, and I'm tempted to agree with him on England. It's not necessarily simple. My regard for Steven Gerrard as a footballer is such that Rooney probably proved more or found more recompense for his talent throughout his career because he chose Manchester United. And Steven Gerrard, his trophy haul is exceptional, particularly in the Ulier treble. If you think about Istanbul, if you think about that FA Cup against West Ham, but across his career, it just reeked of greatness. But one of the things he didn't benefit from was a manager who was utterly and completely clear not only about what a system was, but how it should function and who should be in the composite parts. And therefore, if you fit, Gerrard deserved more than, much though we loved Sven-Göran Eriksson as a guest in our series and still regard him as a great football man, a great storyteller, and his achievements across his career dwarf what might be said about him as England coach. But when he couldn't bring himself to tell Lampard and Gerrard, either one of you sitting out or this is, you must sit, you must organise your Declan Rice or your Calvin Phillips, he didn't do that. And you know, these North-South players spoke really well on BT, and it's worth name-checking them, because when they had a panel or panels that repeatedly featured Rio Ferdinand and Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard before managerial duties took two of them away, the degree to which they spoke frankly was the type of thing that we aspire to in the big interview. And they talked about division, they talked about jealousy, they talked about falling out with one another. Okay, not so much Gerrard and Lampard, but nonetheless, there was a sort of cat and water feeling between the two of them. Their hackles didn't go completely up. They were not a partnership. They were fighting tooth and nail between Chelsea and Liverpool. But worse still is when you listen to Rio Ferdinand and Frank Lampard, having grown up together, close as friends, but close on the pitch too, having shared similar things, having London backgrounds, and yet Lampard probably being the one who would confront it most and talk about the division when Rio Ferdinand was at Manchester United and how they stopped talking and stopped having a friendship. Now, for England, that cost them. And the reason that Roberto, I think that Rooney's decision speaks for itself. And just to treat your suggestion there, I think it dovetails with one of the things I was trying to, don't know if I achieved communicating it, but I've seen it for club level, but Harry Kane dropping deep into a 10 position for England really was exciting. Particularly, he's done it across the tournament in glimpses, less so at the beginning of the tournament, where, number one, he was much more playing as a tired, flat-footed nine. And number two, Souness was still right in one of the descriptions he made about him, about coming deep into midfield, not 10, coming deep into midfield just to get a touch of the ball, just to make what Souness called old man passes. That was right. But gradually, you know, the description that you get on television from ex-pros broadly isn't good enough, and not even close. Some of them are excelsior, but some of them talk about, the common mantra is he's got a goal now and therefore he'll be fine. Well, explain that. It's not just a boost of confidence for a goal scorer means that another goal's coming. That's bullshit. What changes completely, or what changed completely, was Kane's willingness to provide for others. Yeah, if a nine drops back into a 10 position, he's often thinking, if I drop back into a 10 position and either feed it in just inside me either side or wide, I'll get the return pass, and so there's a hint of selfishness. But Kane is definitely playing now that he's as soon as a goal went in, it was like a little thing clicked into place about, yeah, the team's got to win. I'm not accusing him of being selfish, but his decisions now, you know, infinitesimal decisions taken in split seconds, are about doing the right thing all the time. Sometimes he's not capable of it. So the idea of Kane ostensibly being nine in Robert's formation with Rooney in behind him at 10, with two of the wide players on either side, whether you'd even call Grealish a wide player, I'm not so certain, but the combination of skills and instinctive understanding of Rooney and Grealish behind Kane, superb. But Rainey obviously played nine, can play nine, irrespective of the number of goals he got. He had the ability to play wide, 10, 9. But him and Kane interchanging, as Mount is trying to do for Kane at the moment, superb. That prospect is absolutely brilliant.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
But Gerard, Roberto in midfield, either in place of, so partnered by Rice or partnered by Phillips, probably partnered, I think, at this stage by Rice, who's far happier being the defensive shield, the organiser, who I think is growing into an exceptional player. And it's now maybe 2-3 years since I said, if I was, you know, an AC Milan trying to rebuild, Dortmund, Atletico Madrid, I would sign that player right away. At the time, maybe he wasn't quite in that position to walk straight into, you know, Real Madrid or Juventus or Barcelona at that stage. But to my eye, there was no question that that's where he was going to get to. So, Roberto, I'll see your Wayne Rooney and I'll raise your Steven Gerrard, which you are in, Robert. You are in no position to argue against Steve Gerrard's greatness, eh? So I'm taking it that I won that argument with Stevie G. And Martin, you applied the question to both sides, and now this is difficult because Pirlo at that stage gets in any team, anywhere. And probably it's got to be Pirlo. And Balotelli never quite punched his weight, either at club or international level, because his weight was so much greater. I always talk about the Nike boot launch I went to, where there was Cesc Fabregas, Royce. There was Thierry Henry and there was Balotelli. And Balotelli, every trick, every challenge they were asked to do in the new boots in front of an audience, Balotelli was best at. Balotelli gets talked about in terms of his nonsense, his personality, his why owes me, his size and his power. When in fact, he was a sumptuous footballer, extraordinary footballer. And therefore, again, Roberto, I think there's a big debate about the obvious natural brilliance of Pirlo, who gets in ahead of De Rossi, as far as I'm concerned, in this debate. But maybe this team, wouldn't you argue that maybe this team requires an out-and-out striker? And just to deal with Dan's question, Martin, Dan, something special is happening with Chiesa. He's now played about 30 internationals for Italy. And you know, a couple of goals at this tournament are goals 2 and 3. In 30 internationals. Yes, he's 23, but you can hear the sound of a click. You can hear the sound of daring. I think it's Austria where he comes on and scores, and Austria have gone toe-to-toe. Chiesa's little reach out with his right foot, gets high up, slaps the ball down and then finished. That invention, that risk, that, as far as I'm concerned, separates him out, and it was a lovely, lovely, lovely goal. Should have been defended better by Eric Garcia. It's a lovely goal against Spain. But this, yes, I think I've already said Martin referenced that, so I won't speak long about this. I think he makes a big difference about Italy's cutting edge. But I'm saying that on current form, not stats. So at 23 and not 24 till October, having played a lot for Fiorentina as a very young man, and having been schooled at Juventus and having to fight for his place at Juventus, we're watching the click. The click is happening. So I hope he plays, and in Robert's idea, hypothetical world, for my taste, he's probably playing next to, on the right of Balotelli, but they're facing an England midfield with Stevie Gerrard in it, and millions more would be watching on Sunday if that were the case.
Is there any kind of debate over Joe Hart Pickford? And if there is, then it's quite an interesting one because, I mean, it reflects how much football has evolved in the past 7 or 8 years that Pickford is now number one because he has this ability with the ball at his feet. And you know, Hart's inability with the ball at his feet kind of cost him his career, certainly at Man City. So, but it's quite an interesting one because in terms of shot-stopping ability, Joe Hart at the peak of his powers was something to behold.
I think they separate in a couple of ways beyond what you're talking about, which is the reason that Guardiola used for eliminating Joe Hart from the picture at City quite quickly. One of those reasons is that Joe Hart is a huge character and felt he ruled the roost at Manchester City. And when Pep Guardiola comes in, even though I'm not claiming that Joe Hart behaved in a way to, Pep Guardiola had his number down already and went, I tell you how, one of the ways I'm going to make this my dressing room, it's like this. So you have to be a little bit sorry for Joe Hart because personality and owning the dressing room in English football actually gets you a lot of purchase over the years. Unfortunately, the time was changing. The thing that differentiates him from me, Martin, and I love this question that you've posed, is that I'm not, you know, inventing this now. I always said publicly and whenever I was asked to write about the subject that Joe Hart's natural ability and his defiance, his attitude did make him special, but his housekeeping was always poor. There were always moments when a save would be followed by the ball bouncing out where it shouldn't. Percentage moments of the punch instead of the catch, or if a great save was made, does it go around the post or does it drop out? And because it's the sort of paucity in television coverage, the quality of television commentary of football in England, you're still a hero if you made a save, irrespective of the rebound going in, and that's not right. Now, Pickford reminded me a lot of Joe Hart in that capacity, in that clearly shot stopping was one of his things, and he's not bad with the ball at his feet, but I think he had I'm not talking about massive errors. Like Hart, the job wasn't complete. The job of training yourself about how much a goalkeeper's life involves wasn't complete for either of them, but Pickford's worked on it. I think in goalkeeping terms he's worked on it, and he's admitted that he decided it was time to use a sports psychologist. Now, I think that he did that at a time when it was vital, when Henderson or Sam Johnson or Pope, the pack was closing in, and they looked at certain stages pretty remorseless. And I think that he's now also been given Pickford such splendid defence protection, starting from the midfield too. I think when people talk about a goalkeeper and defence protection, they always think about the back five or the back four or whatever. I think that, you know, Phillips and Rice have changed Pickford's life. But I think Pickford has shown something that I'm not convinced Joe Hart consistently understood, which is like, no matter how lauded you are, no matter how secure you feel about your position, tiny details need to be improved. And I think, without ever reaching world-class status, Pickford is on that journey, and listen, you have to commend him for it, I think.
Just for the record, that Italian lineup was Sirigu in goals, a back four of Darmian, Barzagli, Paletta and Chiellini, midfield of Pirlo, De Rossi and Verratti, and I'm going to say a front three of probably Candreva, Balotelli and Marchisio. It's really worth actually going back and watching the highlights of that game, if only for Pirlo's incredible dummy for Marchisio's first goal, which he just lets go through his legs and Marchisio picks it up 25 yards out and scores. It's just wonderful.
Martin, can I give a little bit of value, seeing as you've talked about Marchisio's goal? I was at Wembley the other day, and I was mixing with a lot of people, friends, long-term friends, including friend of the show, Aurelio Capaldi. And Arella's working for Rai Uno, and so is Marchisio. And I have to tell you, and I'm going to name no names, but some serious media protagonists on the English side of this were in the Wembley Hilton and were gazing slack-jawed at Marchisio's beauty. But if Marchisio was admired as a footballer, I think it's wholly unfair that he should now become still more adored and venerated for his abiding good looks and dress sense. We've got to stop this. Sometime next season I'm starting an anti-Italian adulation campaign, because Marchisio, oh man, I tell you what, disgraceful.
I mean, obviously the choice has to be Pirlo, not least because we published his book about 2 months before this game took place. I think Therefore I Play, available in all good bookshops to this day. We always end in a Bet365 Player of the Day, but I think it's a fairly easy choice. Then we've got our first time a combined award for Andrea Pirlo and Wayne Rooney sharing our Bet365 Player of the Day award?
Yeah, if you're stripping Roberto Ryan of that title, given that he's come up with the question that's fired our imaginations and given us this first build-up episode, then, you know, okay. But I think if you would put wee Bobby Ryan and Steven Gerrard and Pirlo or Balotelli and Rooney in a lineup, you'd say, that wee Ryan fella, he's got something, he's got class. So,
okay, folks, that's another show in the bag. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be back with our match day preview tomorrow. Bye for now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.